Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Further proof that when there's music covers, things, you know, it makes the world, well, at least the world is a better place when there's time for music, you know.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence, the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here and checking out the episode. I do hope you hit the subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Which is a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones as well. And you can subscribe at all the usual spots like iTunes and Apple Podcasts. It's Spotify, Podchaser, WFPK.org, NPR.org, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Lyle Lovett. Legendary Lyle Lovett. We're going to be talking, in fact, going deep into his new record, 12th of June. And his career as a multi-genre artist, starting all the way back in the 80s. We'll talk about covering Nat King Cole, the recent retirement of his longstanding duet partner, Francine Reed, and being in a transitional point in his career. Lyle's also going to take us into the new album, which hits on becoming a father for the first time as he hit 60, and how that idea played out in the new material, as well as his summer tour with friend Chris Isaac and their past hijinks. We'll do some Paul Reiser appreciation. You might remember Lyle Lovett not only doing some cameos, but singing the theme song to Mad About You. Speaking of acting, we'll talk about his recent roles alongside Donnie Wahlberg in Blue Bloods and the time he met Tom Waits during the Dead Man Walking concert. So let's do it. Discussing 12th of June, it's Kyle Meredith with Lyle Lovett.
Well, Kyle, thank you for having me on. I've been called Kyle most of my life. I still, some of the older folks at church call me Kyle, and just don't think twice about it. Yeah. And so I always enjoy talking to people named Kyle. I always ask if the reverse is true. Do people ever?
It is true. It's true in the sense that one of my most favorite people in the world. It was a cousin of mine. She was just a couple years older than me and passed away a few years ago. Was my best friend, and through my entire life, she wouldn't call me Kyle. She'd call me Lyle. She could instead of Kyle Meredith, she'd call me Lyle Maurice. That was and of course, I mean this, every time she would say that, if it was your face that popped it, even in the back of my mind, you know.
So I am so sorry.
Well, had this orbit and wasn't a bad thing, I assure you. I promise.
All right, one more question. One more question for you. Do you play music yourself? You play an instrument? You sing?
Not so much these days. I've got a ukulele behind me and I've got a guitar, and I did the band days back in high school and just out of high school. I did about 8 years in a regionally touring band and a bit of a rock thing, and then sort of fell out because I was always obsessively passionate about music, but it wasn't always making the music. It was, you know, just about all those other things. And so you know, that really the interviewing became the thing that I fell into hardest and did that. But every now and then I'll hear a song and I bet that's easy to figure out real quick. And I bought the ukulele the day my son was born in 2008 or 2007. Oh, nice. Yeah. So the day that we brought him home from the hospital, there was a guitar store right across from where I lived at that point, Guitar Emporium here in Louisville. And I walked across the street.
I've been there. That's a great store.
Yeah.
You live close to Guitar Emporium. That's really dangerous.
It was. I was over there a lot. They actually just closed. They did. They closed and put all their inventory in another shop across the river. But it was sad to see them go.
Man.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Institution had been there forever.
That's tragic. Well, I'm always curious. You know, Brian, who you were talking to, Brian was in a band called I-9 that Clive Davis signed to. Was it CBS when Clive was at CBS, Brian? That's right. Clive, yeah, that's right. And y'all made two records for them, right? And the full-length release is the one Nathaniel worked on, correct? Nathaniel Kunkel. I know Brian through Nathaniel Kunkel. We met around 2005, I think, right, Brian? But Nathaniel engineered so many of my recordings, you know, and ended up in the last few years because of the state of the recording business, ended up, you know, getting a real job. And so I was really, really lucky that Chuck Ainley, who did my third album called And His Large Band, was willing to work with me on this one. And I loved working with Chuck. It was like coming home, working with Chuck after all these years. We recorded And His Large Band in 1988. It came out in 1989. So it was just great sitting next to Chuck at the board and going through everything.
The small world we talk about in this industry brings us all together a lot of the time like that. So it's
true. Yeah, it's true. Chuck Ainley has contributed to my life, and he's a wonderful recording engineer, and I'm really proud of the music we've done together. But in 1987, when I was doing the Pontiac album, Chuck was Jimmy Bowen's kind of first pick engineer, and Chuck was doing Reba McEntire at MCA Nashville in those days, Reba and George Strait and the Oak Ridge Boys, the biggest acts on the label, and I was working in the Jimmy Bowen leased the studio complex soundstage in Nashville, just a little few feet off of 16th Avenue, Bowen recorded all his acts in the front stage of soundstage, and I was recording in backstage, which was a smaller studio, and the front stage was interesting because the mixing board was in the recording room. There was no wall separating the control room from where the band would set up. So it was a really direct relationship. But on our breaks in backstage, I'd walk up to front stage, and Chuck would be sitting there at the board late at night, comping tracks and, you know, putting things together. And I'd sit with him, and I'd say, okay, show me what you're doing. And he'd say, he was always really generous about going through things. I remember the first time I heard this amazing sounding kick drum. I said, who's playing that? It was on a Reba McEntire record. And he turned it up so I could really hear it. And he said, that's Russ Kunkel. I thought, wow, if I could ever play with Russ Kunkel. But Chuck, one evening, Chuck said, you want a cup of coffee? I said, you have some? And he pulled out a thermos, and he poured me a cup. And I took a sip, and it was unlike any cup of coffee I'd ever had. I said, what is this? And he said it's a Sumatra that he got from a coffee place in Nashville at the time called Bean Central. So from that day forward, I've had only Sumatra. I drink Sumatra coffee as my coffee of choice, and a place in Austin called Anderson's Coffee roasts beans a couple of times a week, and they do a dark roast Sumatra, and that's...
Do they ship?
That's my go-to. So Chuck, they ship all over the country. They've been shipping to me on the road. I'll give them a hotel or a venue address, and there it is. And
wow.
Things are right in the world. But it's thanks to Chuck Ainley.
My beans right now are from Joshua Tree. I forget it's a place my wife found out there. I'd been drinking some local beans here for a long time, but she took a little solo trip out there and just fell in love with one of the companies and had them shipped, and I should find out the name for moments like this, you know.
It's a magical place.
Yeah, that is a magical place. That is a magical place.
The first time I ever had to play in Louisville, I'm sorry, I know you probably have questions, but I will stop talking eventually. But the first time I ever played in Louisville was to go up to do the old Lonesome Pines special. Dick Van Cleek produced that, and he had us up at the Kentucky Center for the Arts in the small room there to mm-hmm. do that taping. And we stayed at the Galt House and heard the Calliope, and you know, had the full-on Louisville experience. And I've always been excited to come back to Louisville every time and play.
Well, when was that? When was that?
That would have been in '87, I believe.
It's so interesting, you know. And I was thinking about this, you know, just as I was thinking about this interview and stuff, and you know, you and back in the '80s, because you know, for whatever genre has been and coming up in the country world, I think in my head and a lot of people's head too, you know, like I've got REM over my shoulder, and especially in the 80s and late 80s, you know, college rock being such a thing. And I think I've always probably considered you more in that world than the world of Reba. And I mean, again, which is also the stuff I grew up with in Litchfield, but just considering, I think what we think of in the pop culture sense of what the 80s were, and then realizing, you know, like the music that you're making there, you know, it comes out of that same world. It's always interesting the way history writes things like that, I guess.
Well, you know, I went to Nashville in 1984 because my friend Nancy Griffith invited me to sing a harmony with her on a record she was doing. It ended up on Rounder Records that Jim Rooney produced. And I thought, well, as long as I'm going to Nashville, I may as well see what I can find out about the record business. And my mom and dad both worked for Exxon, the old Humble, they met working for the old Humble Company in the 50s. And my dad's boss at the time had his oldest son was going to school at Middle Tennessee State University in a music business program. He played in bands growing up in high school around Houston, and decided he wanted to work in the music business. His name was Bo Bress, and Bo asked me, you know, a very logical question. He said, "Do you know about the performing rights organizations?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm an ASCAP member. I joined ASCAP when I started copywriting my songs a few years ago, back in 1978 or 79." He said, "Let me make a call for you at ASCAP." He said, I'm sure we can get a meeting for you with a membership rep." And I said, "Do you think they'd talk to me?" He said, "Well, it's their job to talk to their songwriters." And so that's how I started meeting people and hanging at the recording studio, at Jack Clements' recording studio, with Nancy and her entire recording band and Jim Rooney. That was my introduction to the business. In 1984, I was 26 and had gotten to the point that I was playing the same half a dozen or so clubs every couple of months, and really had gotten to a point in my life that I thought, you know, I need to figure out if this can be a real job, or I need to figure out what I'm really going to do and what, you know, what I am going to do for a real job. And so I was grateful for the chance to go to Nashville, drove my truck to Nashville and just had the best week there with Nancy and met all kind of people and received enough encouragement to keep coming back every few weeks. You know, ultimately it was through Jim Rooney that I met the folks at Criterion Music in Nashville and then in Los Angeles, and they signed me to a publishing deal. Bo Goldson with Criterion signed me to a publishing deal, and then they put me together with Dick Whitehouse and Curb Records, and Curb took me to MCA Records, where I worked with Tony Brown. And in 1984 in Nashville, it was good timing, unbeknownst to me. At the supermarket, I'll stand in the shortest line, and it'll move a lot slower than the longer line. At the airport in security, I never picked the right line to get through. That 1984 trip in Nashville was the right line because Nashville was looking for something new. What I heard all the record producers and publishers talking about in 1984 was the discrepancy between big radio hits and record sales. People were having big hits on the radio, but sales were not what they had been during the previous wave of success, which was the Urban Cowboy era. And the Urban Cowboy era had kind of played itself out by 1984. And Nashville was in an experimental phase. You know, my first record came out the same year Steve Earle's first record came out. Dwight Yoakam's record came out just a few months before that. Katie Lang was a new artist. Sweethearts of the Rodeo were a new artist. Nancy was a new artist. It was a time when not traditional country acts were being signed and released in Nashville. So the way I think about it now, I mean, I'm grateful for my first three records being released from MCA Nashville, and I'm always happy when people just know about me. And I'm often referred to as a country singer, but people who really listen to country music don't think of me as a country performer. It's really people who aren't as familiar with country music who do think of me as country. Yeah, but I like country instrumentation as well, you know.
I mean, most of my favorite artists, that's how I would, I'm saying me personally, you know. It's like, again, you just look around, my wall is Bowie behind me and everybody else. You know, these are the artists that, you know, all the genres. It's like, you know, the world's, and but that is interesting. I think that's the universe giving you some cosmic balance right there. We're going to give you the shortest line in Nashville, but you're going to have to put up with the longest lines or the wrong lines every other time. And if you can handle that, then you're fine.
That's okay with me. That's right. It's a fair trade.
Of course, you know, I'll draw that into the record at hand here, 12th of June, which, let me give you the compliments, is just fantastic. It's you know,
thank you.
You know, for us having to wait a little bit longer as it goes to get this one. I mean, it does everything that I was hoping it would do. But, you know, you do get those moments. I was so happy to see that you were doing the studio version of Straighten Up and Fly Right. I think that's, I'd put that in my top 20 greatest songs of all time.
Right, me too. You know, and that it was one of those. That's a song that I would never have approached, but years ago, back in the late '90s, and correct me if I've got my date wrong, but Gary Marshall did a film called Dear God and asked me to record that for Dear God, for the soundtrack, and so I did with the guys in the band, and it kind of became. You know, Gary Marshall gave me permission to approach that great Nat King Cole classic, and otherwise it would be, you know, I just wouldn't have. But as, you know, over the years, it just became a song that we in the band enjoyed playing. And the last few years, I started doing it as a duet with Francine Reed to have more for her to do in the show. And that and G Baby Ain't I Good to You, I recorded with Matt Rawlings on his first solo record for the MCA Master Series. Mm-hmm. And Matt picked that one and asked me to sing that with him. So another case of someone else giving me permission to do it. Otherwise, you know, I just wouldn't have. And so to do those two Nat King Cole classics, you know, it's great fun. I mean, there's nothing better than singing a great song and feeling like you have a right to sing it, and doing those with Francine is just fun every time. And so putting those on the record was a way to give folks who'd been to the live shows the last few years a recorded version of Francine's and my doing them, and also a great way to show the band, and a great way to show, you know, sort of the breadth of the large band and Charles Rose's arrangements, and so they were a good way to show the band and Francine. So I just felt like I had to do it.
Maybe you would, but I don't know if you'd put yourself in the same box here. But I thought, as we're talking about the type of artists who, you know, are sort of outside of genre a lot, Nat was one of those for me. You know, because I was like, you know what, to me it makes sense as a fan that you would cover Nat King Cole, because it seems like you guys are, you know, made from the same cloth. I mean, when you listen to him doing Nature Boy and, you know, and then compare it to something to, you know, Straighten Up. I mean, you know, just.
You're too young to remember, but I, you know, when I was a boy, I remember watching his television show with my parents, and I just always loved him. I always loved him. He was so dignified and you know, elegant, just elegant. Watching his variety show was something I looked forward to every week.
Yeah, just one of the most unique artists I think that's ever been out there.
So distinctive, huh? You know, and reading those early Ray Charles liner notes and those Atlantic records, you're talking about how, you know, Ray Charles wanted to play piano like Nat King Cole, and when you hear those instrumental records like the genius of Ray Charles, the great Ray Charles, you hear the instrumentals on those. You hear it. You hear that kind of phrasing. You hear those kinds of choices, and Nat King Cole's influence, you know, is great, far and wide.
Yeah, you mentioned Francine on this. You know, your duet partner for all of these years. Did I read right that she's retiring from the road?
She and that happened during the pandemic isolation. She decided that, you know, that she just, you know, didn't really want to tour anymore. She's still going to play dates and she'll still do the occasional date with us. But I think the, you know, we work a lot when we go on tour. I mean, we play just because of the size of the band and all of our expenses. We have to play 5 and 6 nights a week just to make sure it all comes out. And that's, you know, it's a lot. Francine will be 75 this July. And she's, you know, like a lot of folks, kind of figured, you know, readjusted or made adjustments in the pandemic and you know, figured out ways to do things, you know, a different way. I worked with the same sound man and sound company from 1988 until this year, John Richards and his company Concert Production from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John mixed every show I played from 1988 until the beginning of pandemic isolation, until March 7, 2020. And John decided during the pandemic that he didn't want to tour anymore. So that it was as big a shakeup for me, an adjustment for me as anything. Yeah. But yeah, coming through the isolation and going back out, you know, things, we've all had to make adjustments, and some folks have decided that, you know, that was enough for them. And I don't think, I mean, as we recorded the tracks in November of 2019, I looked forward to playing those songs with Francine. And we recorded Peel Me a Grape as a way to do a song we hadn't been doing yet on stage. So I looked forward to doing that. But at the same time, if I had known in November 2019 that Francine would retire from touring, I think I still would have done those songs because we had done them. I don't think it would have changed my choices for the album.
I mean, it's all things considered, new father, as we get into a lot of this album too, and band member changes and crew changes. I mean, does it feel like, you know, this is a time of transition as much as it sounds like?
It does feel like a time of transition to me. I'm grateful for the players in the band who still want to play and have stuck with me, and I'm grateful for everything John Richards and his crew did for me. But we did our first tour since the beginning of the pandemic was this winter and spring, started on the 26th of February. And we went out with our with a smaller group that I call the acoustic group, and there were just 5 of us on stage. But we had, with the exception of our monitor engineer, we had an entirely different production crew, and that was, yeah, that was a, you know, it was interesting, you know. Yeah, there's a real luxury and comfort in seeing the same people, you know, tour to tour, and being able to step right in and pick up right where you left off. And this time it wasn't that way. It all went smoothly, but it was a different experience. And we're working with Claire, you know, the great sound company, and their equipment was stellar, and the folks that they supplied for us to run their equipment were likewise stellar. And so that was all a good experience, but it was different. You know, I missed some of my old friends.
Especially after that many years. I mean, just the phrase well-oiled machine comes to mind, but just to be able to.
Well, that's true. You know, there's so much, you know, there's so much. Well, and it felt that way working with Chuck Ainley again, even after 30 years. Working with Nathaniel Kunkel so consistently over the years, Russ's son, was, you know, we almost didn't have to speak to one another. We could just look across the room. You know, that nonverbal communication, the understanding, just knowing someone that well is, you know, there's a shorthand you develop that you know, is not the same when you're starting over with people.
Well, I'll bring up the parenthood, because I know that's a big part of the story of this record right here. And we kind of mentioned that. I mean, from one, you know, the lighthearted side, we get Pants Is Overrated, which I think I figured out somewhere, heard somewhere that a bit inspired by your kids' birthday suits anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. I mean, just the, you know, when you're just trying to get a 2-year-old dressed, you know, and finally you sort of give up and you think, well, maybe they're right. Maybe they've got it right. Maybe I'm the one who has it wrong.
You know, for a lot of us around here, you know, potty training just meant putting the kid out pantsless in the yard and saying, this is, you figure this out. Yeah, this is.
we didn't take that approach, but yeah, no, all of that, you know, I know lots of other people have had children, but you know, when it happens to you, it does feel, it's just such a revelation. And I've just enjoyed every second of it. I always thought I wanted to have children, but I had no idea how much I'd enjoy it. And just every bit of it. And I feel so lucky. I was home from the 8th of March. Our last show before the pandemic was on the 7th of March in Breckenridge, Colorado. And it was an acoustic group tour. And I flew home on the 8th of March. And was with my children almost every day and night for a full 2 years. And you know, they were 2.5 then. And by the time I went back on tour, they were 4.5. And that's something I really am grateful. That time is something I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, blessings of what would was a dark time in the world's history. You know, you get those small silver linings.
Well, it was a dark time and continues to be a dark time. I think it's still very serious. And even though things are better, you know, I think we still have to be cautious. I'm excited that, you know, that they'll be 5 in June and eligible to get vaccinated. I'll rest a little easier when that happens. And I know, you know, I know I've read, you know, as much as I could. And, you know, I know that they say children by and large do well with the virus, but I would still rather they not get it. And my mom's 92. And so we were pretty careful during the, I mean, you know, didn't we, we still haven't eaten inside in a restaurant. But we did, you know, several months ago, we started getting takeout food. And just lately we've started sitting outside, and every step back that you take is you know, it's a great feeling and feels like progress. So I hope for the entire world that things can become more and more normal.
Well, the other side of that levity is the beautiful title track that you've written here with 12th of June. And you know, songwriters do it all the time, right? You have a kid, you have kids, and there's the songs that go along with it. But I feel like there's something special about this song, a little bit different. You know, I'd love to know, because it wasn't just that you said, I'm going to write the song to my kids. I mean, it does take a wider scope angle to it at the same time. What was the thought that went into that? I mean, how did you approach it?
Well, I really never considered my age until they were born, until I knew they were going to be born. And I started doing the math and thinking, gosh, by the time they're in kindergarten or in first grade, I'll be 64, 65. You know, by the time they graduate high school, will I get to experience that with them? And so I've written songs before from the point of view of the dead guy at his funeral. And so this is just this is another one of those. We have a family cemetery in San Jacinto County in Texas. And there's a little creek that runs by the, it's a tributary to the main creek. And it runs by the cemetery that we always played in as kids. And that was always referred to, and my dad always called the branch. So that's, you know, really was just describing the setting. And that's really what it is, you know, sort of being at the end of your life and being grateful for all of it, and that's, you know, having children has made me feel that way. You know, if nobody listens to this record and if nobody shows up at another show, I will still be happy with my life because of them.
That line, I will love you 3 forever, though I fly beyond this life. I mean, the best songs are the ones that just punch you right in the stomach when you're not really expecting it. You know, take the breath away, and that's definitely one of those great moments.
Well, thank you. It was about to be their first birthday, songs are. I'm not a terribly disciplined writer. I don't feel. I don't feel as though I'm the kind of writer that could write just anything. If I were given an assignment, I'm not sure that I would be able to come up with something. I don't feel. I admire songwriters who are great craftsmen, and I don't know that I am. But I was just thinking about their first birthday, and I was out running errands and sort of thinking of the melody and lines and my main thought was I don't have time to work on this right now, and I don't even want to work on it, but it just kind of wouldn't leave me alone, and I've made up other songs in that same way where you think my first thought is I can't think about this right now, I've got serious stuff to do. But they just kind of keep tapping you on the shoulder, keep, mm-hmm. Playing themselves in your head. And so that's how that one happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've written one of the all time greats there. And then in that lineage that you're talking about too, there's some folks I've read about that, was kind of comparing it as far as thematically as you're talking to Family Reserve. And for you, do you ever consider that writing, I don't know if you call it a sequel song or just continuing that story?
You know, I didn't really think of it in that way, but I certainly see that analogy. But it's just a consistent emotion. It really wasn't designed to be a sequel. The other night on stage in New York, I talked about a song on the record called "Her Loving Man," being sort of an update to "She's No Lady," but it really wasn't intended to be. But it's I'm the same person and have the same kind of point of view and the same emotional response to a similar situation. So it's in that way, it's it's just the consistency that makes it seem like it might be. It's just a slightly different facet to this similar idea.
This one might be an obvious one, but what inspired Pigmeat Man? Because that's a fun one.
It's my son. I mean, he's so far in his young life he's a vegetarian, except for he loves bacon.
Well, it's a good bacon thing to love. I mean, that's
once again, I feel like he's right.
Right. He's right. But I write down little critics with truth bombs. That's how I feel about kids too. Little critics with truth bombs.
Isn't it the truth? That's one of my favorite things about being a dad is you do get the unvarnished truth always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine's about to turn 15 this year, and that's been the whole time right here. It's like, what did I know? But you try to, they think of you as this all-knowing thing, so it's hard to destroy that. You know, we're getting to the point where I think my kids figured that part out, though. He's got the truth now behind it, so it's
you kind of don't want to ruin it for him, do you? I know, and it just makes you feel great when they ask you a question you couldn't possibly know the answer to, that they think that much of you. And you just want to do your best to not let them down. Huh?
That's true. Well, you're going to take this out on the road. I see some co-headlining dates with Chris Isaak. There's a dream little bill right there for me, at least.
Chris Isaak. Chris is such a wonderful person. He was nice enough to do. Over the course of the pandemic isolation, I did 20 live streams with my friend Brian Whitman and his company Sear, and we did these live streams. We did 16 of them for a ticket, and a $10 ticket. And Chris Isaak did one of those with me in October of 2020, and he was such a joy to work with. Preparing for a live stream, Brian and I did them every 3 to 4 weeks. And getting ready for the live streams, sort of doing tech rehearsals and just talking about what we might talk about when we did the live stream, talking about songs. Chris was so detailed. And those conversations, those rehearsal conversations, were so much fun, you know, just to be able to spend some time with an artist you admire. I just enjoyed those immensely. And Chris was so detailed. Chris was, I never asked anyone to send me a set list, what they might play in our song swap format. But the evening before, Chris just sent me, he said, these are the songs I'm going to play, and in this order. And the day we were that afternoon, we were getting ready for the show that evening, and he texted me. He said, here's what I'm wearing. Here's what I'm wearing. And I thought, how nice, you know, so I was able to dress accordingly. He was just very thoughtful and very detailed and on camera, you know, really loose and had a great sense of humor. We'd run into each other a few years before. We've done some, you know, special events over the years. We did a Johnny Cash special years ago and did a Buddy Holly tribute special together. For that Buddy Holly tribute record that Peter Asher produced. Mm-hmm. But we were about to go on stage at the Mountain Winery in Saratoga, California, a few years ago. And in the wings, I saw this guy standing in the wings holding a dog. And I looked and I thought, my goodness, that's Chris Isaak. And he was playing the next night at the Mountain Winery. And he came to our show. I was shocked and so pleased. And I went over to him, and we were about to go on. I mean, in a couple of minutes, I said, I can't believe you're here. Would you be willing to walk out on stage at the beginning of our show? Would you be willing to walk out on stage and welcome people, act like you got your nights mixed up? Would you be willing to go out there? And he said, yeah, sure. Just like that. And he walked up, hey, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So happy to be back here at the Mountain Winery. And did this whole thing. And you could see the blank look on people's faces. It was just perfect.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And so he's got a wonderful sense of humor. And I'm really looking forward to playing shows with him this summer. We're doing, I think, 21 shows across the summer. He's doing some of his own shows. We're doing some of our own shows. But then we get together a few times across the whole country.
Yeah, his TV show, I think, was one of the you know, one of the best little gems, you know, hidden little gems. And yeah,
oh, he's a great actor, huh? I mean to see him in the Twin Peaks films that David Lynch, you know, saw that in him, and he's just right on.
Have you never been in the same thing? Because there's a missed opportunity, like film wise.
we'll just have to do our own show this summer. We'll come up with some kind of something.
Keep the cameras rolling.
This is our setup for streaming, and that was, you know, I mean, to figure it really was it was fun to get to perform when we couldn't perform out in public, but it was also, you know, it actually helped us survive, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought of a ticket price. I mean, the most consistent nice comment that we always got on our live streams was, you know, thanks for doing the live stream, but we're eager to see you live again. And so I used to tell people, it's, you know, it's not the same as playing live, but it's different. Because it was different, you know, because you're sort of alone in a closet or a garage and talking to one person, there was conversation that wouldn't have happened if we were doing the show together in front of an audience. You know, there was more. It was more conversational. People tend to something that's always surprised me, and because I was a journalism major in college, if you ask somebody a question, they tend to answer it. Now, why? I have no idea. You know, the reason I'm not a journalist is because I would get to a point in interviews and I think to myself, you know, that's just not any of my business. And I know you can't think that way when you're a journalist, but I would kind of stop myself. But I really enjoyed the conversations I had, because doing a deal like this, I mean, you do kind of lose sight of the fact that gosh, other people are watching it. And so I really enjoyed the conversations I was able to have. Chris, as you and I were talking about, Chris was so smart and so funny, and everyone brought their own quality to those live streams. And I wouldn't have asked my friends for a favor. Would you do this with me? But I didn't have to ask him for a favor. I was able to call him up and offer him a gig, and that was a great feeling. Because we split after our expenses, after paying Brian's company and our advertising expenses, we just split down the middle, what we made from the show, and I was I was able to offer folks a gig, and I enjoyed that.
That's beautiful. Do you take that further? Like you go out on the road with Chris. I mean, is there a moment where you guys can just stop in the middle of the show and talk to each other in that way?
I hope so. We're talking about, we've been going back and forth talking about songs that we might do together. So we definitely want that to be part of the show. And so I can't imagine our not talking.
I'd love to see that continue. I mean, I agree with you. One of the coolest things about the last couple of years of being able to have that view of our favorite artists, it's intimate's an easy word to throw around, and that can certainly be used here, but it was different. It was personal.
Well, it was, and I've the folks that tuned in, the folks that paid $10, made a difference in my life, and helped me to, we had to reorganize some things, and they really helped us survive. This past week, when we played at the City Winery in New York, we did six shows in four nights, and there were people who shouted out from the audience, thanks for the live streams. And that was a wonderful feeling. Gave me a chance to thank them, because it really did help us.
Six shows in four nights. That's like playing at the Fillmore back in the 60s and 70s right there, the evening show and the night show.
I was so glad that folks went, that we were able to do that. But one show a night, we did two shows each Thursday and Friday night. And I'm terrible about cutting a show down. We played one show on Tuesday, one show on Wednesday. And so then when it got to Thursday and Friday, I thought, well, we can't really shortchange the folks, who stepped up and wanted to come to the late show. We can't do that. And we can't shortchange the folks that bought tickets first for the early show. So we did two and a half hour sets on Thursday night and Friday night. I mean, wow. We were literally on stage for 5 hours, and the guys in the band were so nice about it. I mean, they were so nice about it, but it was, the end, we felt like we'd done something at the end of Friday night for sure.
Yeah. Take that, Springsteen. 3 hours.
Yeah.
Child's play right there. That's Oh, that's great. I'm so looking forward to this series. I really am. And I quickly do want to ask just about the other side of your life, because acting's always been, as we've talked about it along with Chris, such an interesting part of what you do. One of my pandemic shows that I decided just to do the whole thing while I had the time was Mad About You, which of course you got to do the theme song again. Yeah. And I had Paul Reiser on here not too long ago, actually, to talk to him.
Paul's great, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's so smart. Gosh.
Oh, one of the best right there.
So funny. And he and Michael McDonald have just done a book together. That's wonderful. It's not out yet, but it'll be out. But they wrote it together, and Paul is just brilliant.
So you've been popping up. I saw Blue Bloods, your music's all over that series From on Epics. What's next? I mean, do you stay active in that? Do you audition, or is this usually somebody comes to you?
I am not an actor, but I occasionally get to play one on TV. I really enjoy acting, but it was just kind of an accidental thing for me. Robert Altman came to the show we did at the Greek Theater in the summer of 1990 on the tour that we opened for Ricky Lee Jones, and called me up after that. And so occasionally somebody thinks of me for a part. I have auditioned in the past, but I haven't auditioned in years and years. And I don't pursue acting in the way that actors do. Just occasionally somebody thinks of me. Ian Biederman is a writer-producer on Blue Bloods. was at that same show that Altman was at in 1990. He was a youngster. And he, you know, he made up this part for me in Blue Bloods. And so it's thanks to him that I've been on that show a couple of times. It's great fun. I really enjoy getting to, I feel like I get to peek in the windows of acting and see a little bit what it's like. It has given me a tremendous respect for actors and what actors do. You know, the people who are, well, people who are really good at something make it look easy. But being on set and watching someone's process, you know, it's given me it makes me realize it's not easy. There's a lot to it. They just are really great at it. Working with Donnie Wahlberg is, you know, he's so gifted. I mean, such a gifted musician. But on set, he's so, you know, so knows what he's doing and so helpful to me. And getting to do all my scenes with Donnie was just a real treat. I mean, he and I have gotten to be friends you know, just watching someone who really knows what he's doing do that thing is a privilege. And it's just an education. I mean, there's so much to learn. Working on those Altman films, working with Don Roos and The Opposite of Sex, you know, getting to work with Lisa Kudrow and see her comedy up close and see her, how dramatic she could also be and just how deep her understanding of human nature is. I mean, there's a real lesson, you know, a lesson in life from all the talented people you get to work with. I feel that way when I'm on stage with my band, you know, standing on stage with Russ Kunkel. And Will Lee played bass with us on these New York dates. Leland Sklar will be playing bass this summer. I mean, to be on stage with them and Jim Cox on piano and Luke Bulla on fiddle, Jeff White on mandolin guitar. I mean, Jeff's a veteran of the bluegrass world. It's, you know, and the great singers, Willie Green Jr. and Lamont Van Hook and Jason Eskridge. You know, it's in the horn section, you know, the Muscle Shoals. Two of our horn section are from the Muscle Shoals horns. Our alto player is Brad Lely, the professor of saxophone at the University of North Texas. I mean, he's just amazing. I met Brad in 1990 when I sat in with Harry Connick and his band. Brad was playing with Harry. The Mace Hibbard is playing tenor, took Harvey Thompson's place. Harvey was one of the old Muscle Shoals guys and decided he was, you know, Harvey's 80 now, I guess, and doesn't tour anymore. But Mace, originally from Waco, Texas. It's a privilege to be on stage with such talented people. And for me, it's, you know, going to band camp every day. Getting to work in films the same way. I get to, it's like, you know, a dream to just see what it's like.
All of my favorite artists are the ones who are so artistically creative beyond the song. You know, as mentioned, you and Chris, Isaac, Tom Waits, Bowie, whoever, you know, whoever we're talking about. I mean, just being able to be a fan and have all of that. I mean, let me say this, Lyle, you spoil us. You really do with everything you do, the music and all of it.
You must have interviewed Waits over the years, huh?
I have never. I don't know that I'll ever get a chance to talk to Tom. I mean, he seems a bit, you know, beyond that at this point. But, you know, I mean, he hasn't released... You and him released your last record the same year, and he hasn't followed that up yet. So, I don't know.
Waits is one of my favorites. I met him only once. It was at the Dead Man Walking concert. You know, Tim Robbins' film Dead Man Walking with Sean Penn. There was a night at the Shrine Auditorium concert, and Eddie Vedder was part of it. But Waits, I went down to his dressing room and he was so cool. I mean, he extended his hand. He said, "People tell me that we look similar. I just like to apologize." That's what he said. It's very sweet.
That's a nice line to get. That seems like a very Tom Waits line right there. That's
man, so cool. Yeah. What about Bowie? You ever meet Bowie?
No, I never met Bowie either. That was probably top of my list, but he was already kind of retired by the time I was doing these. So,
what's that like? When I turned 50, there was a wonderful journalist who supported me my whole career, named George Varga, at San Diego Union Tribune, and George was doing it. I was doing an interview, and he just turned 50, I'm 64 now. I turned 50. He said, well, what about retirement? When you've been thinking about it? And I said, no, George, I can't retire. I said, finally, I said, you know, if getting to do something you want to do that you love to do every day of your life is what you do when you retire, then I've always been retired. And then at the end of that interview, he said, well, I've been asking everybody this lately, how would you like to be remembered? And I said, okay, you're trying to get me to quit, and now you're trying to kill me off. What's the deal? So I said I'm gonna have to think about that. And so I called him back about 10 minutes later. I said, okay, I've got it. He said, all right, how would you like to be remembered? And I said to him, you know, I want him to say he was really old. So
that's how it's gonna be written. You know, he was really old.
I hope that's true. And I'm grateful for this life and career that I've gotten to have. I would never have dreamed in 1976, when I was 18 years old and first started playing as a job anywhere that would book me, I would never have, or even in 1986 when my first album came out, that in 2022 I'd be able to continue, you know, still doing it. I just would never have thought that, and I'm just grateful.
Well, congrats on a career that has been like a full-time retirement from the very beginning.
Thank you.
That's not a bad way to do it right there. I completely agree with you. It's. Lyle, seriously, this record is so good. The fact that you're in 2022 and making some of your best music that you've ever made, I think that just goes to show, you know, what kind of artist you are. So thanks for continuing to do that. And man, this has been so much fun.
Thank you, and thanks to all of everybody that contributed to the record. I mean, it's a collaboration, and there's not a greater privilege than to work with talented people every day of your life.
Well, I think that concludes our time here. So this has been it's been such an honor and a joy. I really do appreciate you taking the time for it.
Thanks for helping us get the word out about the record, and I'm thrilled to meet you, and just continued good luck to you. Have fun with Joe Scarborough and Morning Joe. It's one of my favorite programs.
Right on. I'll make sure to tell him you're saying hi.
Please do.
And once things calm down again and we'll get some music back on there, hopefully we can get you back on the show as well. So I'd love to do a whole thing on set with everybody.
That would be really fun.
Yeah, cool.
Joe's tall.
He's taller than I expected he would be. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I don't know what he's drinking, but he looks younger than me right now. That's bothering me because I think he's about 10 years older. So
he does look great. It's hard to sing on the same mic with him.
Thank you, Lyle. Thank you, Brian, too, for both making this happen. Hopefully we'll see you both around sometime real soon.
Brian, cut out all my stuff and just send Kyle his part. It'll be better.
Just the parts where I compliment him. Keep that stuff.
Thank you.
And my thanks to Lyle Lovett. That was such a fun interview. Big thanks to you as well for checking out the episode. Again, the new album is called 12th of June. You definitely got to check that out. And please do subscribe to this series since you made it this far so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week. New ones every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover some new ones as well. At iTunes and Apple Podcasts, at Spotify, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from, subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Then after that, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. It's an hour full of song premieres, of music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all three of them at Kyle Meredith. Do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
You know, we get fired every gig. Every show, we get fired and have to start over every day.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org, from Louisville Public Media.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.